What was Nechama Leibovitz's contribution to Bible scholarship? What were its roots in her education and early teaching career? Nechama offered a vision that integrates Tanakh study and academic scholarship, a defining feature of Revel Graduate School and the Torah Mada philosophy of YU in general. Nechama Leibovitz, a master teacher, is a kind of celebrity. But Nechama herself didn't like the idea of celebrity, and she was a very humble person and saw herself as a guide to others to teach them how to learn on their own in depth. And in that spirit, I would like to evaluate her contributions to scholarship critically and explore how they can be for us a model for study of Tanakh in the 21st century. Let me begin by considering the methods Nechama was exposed to in her formative years of university study in Germany in the 1920s. The first section of the handout lists various schools of Bible interpretation current at the time. Nechama, of course, was well-versed in the classical Jewish commentators, which she learned from home, and in her day, those were typically learned by rote. You memorized the various opinions and you went on to the next page. In university, she learned the intellectually stimulating historical and source-critical methods, which dominated Bible scholarship in Europe since the 19th century. These rejected the Bible's divine authorship and viewed it as a type of ancient Near Eastern literature, which was just being discovered then. The source-critical method led to the documentary hypothesis, which views the Torah as a patchwork of different sources from different time periods. For obvious reasons, Nechama found this approach contradictory to Orthodox Judaism, as did Rav David Zvi Hoffman earlier in the 20th century. But the challenge Nechama accepted was to make traditional Tanakh study intellectually stimulating. To do so, she adapted another method that was just flowering in the early 20th century, in the 1920s. The literary study of Bible analysis, developed by Buber and Rosenzweig, followed by Ludwig Strauss, to whom Nechama became attached in Israel, though she may have already known him in Germany. Buber and Rosenzweig composed a Bible translation that captures the nuances of the original Hebrew wording, its syntax and poetic qualities, the very aspects of Tanakh that are often lost in translation. In his writings on the Bible, Buber engaged in what is known as close reading and paid special attention to word order, repetitions, and imagery, and argued that they all have expressive functions. To give an example, there's a difference between saying, "she walked steadily," and "steadily she walked." There's no difference in terms of the content of the two sentences, but the difference of syntax produces a different feeling, which is paramount in poetry. And Buber, like Rosenzweig, treated the Bible as poetry. Nechama showed how in Tanakh as well, syntax can be expressive. Just compare two adjacent psukim in Shmot Yud Gimel, Shivat Yamim Tochlu Matzot, and the next pasuk, Matzot Ye'achel Eit Shivat Hayamim. The second is a much less natural order, Matzot Ye'achel Eit Shivat Hayamim, but it puts emphasis on Matzot Ye'achel. The literary method and close reading approach became popular in the late 20th century, and you see here the quote from Robert Alter, literary analysis means paying minutely discriminating attention to the artful use of language, tone, sound, and imagery, which has illuminated the poetry of Dante and the plays of Shakespeare. The historical and source-critical methods see the Bible as a kind of artifact, as a tool for getting at the ancient history of Israel, and reveal its developing systems of thought, which they considered at times contradictory. To give a particular example, when the Torah tells the story of God walking through the Garden of Eden as though he were human, and seeking a man and saying, "Ayeka, where are you?" So some scholars say, what does that tell you? That according to the author of this source in the documentary hypothesis, God doesn't know where Adam really was. He's not omniscient. Yeah, that's what some scholars thought and claimed. The literary method, by contrast, analyzes the Bible as a text as a whole without concern for its earlier layers of development, if there ever were such a thing. It views the Bible instead as an artistic whole to be analyzed for what the text says to us as readers. Imagine the Bible as a work of art, like a painting. Now, there may be various sources of inspiration for the painter, but when you look at the painting, you ask, what does it mean to me, irrespective of what the earlier painter's sources may have been. Now, the literary method wasn't first devised for Bible scholarship. It was applied in the New Criticism, as it was called, in the 1920s and 30s to counteract the prevailing historical critical method in general literature. So, for example, historical critical scholars looked at Shakespeare's works or Milton's works and tried to see what sources they came from and how Milton may have reworked his sources. But the New Criticism rejected that and said, let's look at the works of Shakespeare and Milton and other authors as artistic portrayals that reveal the depths of the eternal human condition. When I was studying with Nechama in the 1980s, after having earned a master's degree in comp literature and pursuing my Revel doctorate in Tanakh, we would often discuss literary theory and how it developed since the 1920s, when Nechama was a student. I vividly recall her telling me that she found the New Criticism, just beginning at that time, to be especially congenial, as you see in the next citation on the source sheet. Here Nechama reveals that our great commentators engaged in close readings of the Bible as defined by the New Criticism. In other words, they manifest deep sensitivities to the nuances of the language of Tanakh, treating it as a work of literary art. Nechama even identifies an expression similar to the New Criticism in the words of the Netziv cited in the next paragraph. As the Netziv points out, the pasuk "V'ata kitvu lachem et hashira hazot" is taken by the rabbis to indicate that every Jew is obligated to write a Sefer Torah. But it only says "kitvu et hashira hazot," write this poem. So the Netziv says that rabbis assume that the entire Torah is poetry, and it's different from prose. And there is actually no real Hebrew word for prose. If you think in modern Hebrew, it's prosa. Okay, that's not a biblical word. The Netziv is very clever. He says here, sipur prazi, because there is the Arei HaPrazi, an unwalled city, so the Netziv borrowed that term. That's very clever. But in any case, the Netziv says that poetry is written in an enigmatic way with connotations and unwritten expressiveness. And that means that every nuance must be interpreted. And when you interpret poetry that way, it's not just drash. That's what you're supposed to do in poetry. You're supposed to read between the lines. Nechama Leibovitz famously asked the question, Ma kasheh l'Rashi, as Mrs. Manischewitz recounted, and that means that she was saying that in 1938, already at the beginning of her way. And we all know this question very well. Nechama would show that if you understand the textual trigger that prompted Rashi to bring the Midrash, you can understand that in Rashi's work, it's not simply a Midrashic elaboration, it is what the text itself says, as the Netziv pointed out. Now, of course, Nechama was not the first to ask the question, Ma kasheh l'Rashi? All of the super commentaries on Rashi, Mefarshei Rashi, already ask this question. And so we have to ask ourselves, what is new about Nechama's methodology? But just a note of station identification, as you see on the handout, on the flyer out that's out on your seats, we will be having an event on January 28th where Professor Yeshayahu Maori will be speaking about the Mefarshei Rashi, the classical Mefarshei Rashi. But now back to our question. So what's new about Nechama's Ma kasheh l'Rashi? I'd like to show that her analysis is fundamentally different because it is inspired and motivated by the New Criticism, which enables Nechama to reveal Rashi's literary sensitivities. I reviewed my notes from my first classes with Nechama Leibovitz recently, and I saw that the very first thing that was in there was, she said to us, why do you need a commentary? Why can't you just have a translation? Just translate the Bible and that's enough. Why do you need a perush? So her answer is that sometimes words carry additional connotations. So she gave us an example, and this is her example. She said, the word mayim. Mayim means water, H2O. So just say water, that's it. You don't need any further elaboration. But she said, if I say, ha-kafe hazeh, einenu kafe, hu mayim. Okay? So, and that was her example. She must have had a bad coffee day. So it means something that's tasteless. So you have to ask, what is the additional connotation? That, of course, applies to Tanakh, as we'll see. Let's look at example one in the source sheet. Rashi's comment on the verse mentioned above, where God asks Adam, Ayeka. The source critics took it literally, assuming that God doesn't know where Adam is. But Rashi notes that this was simply a way of God engaging Adam in conversation, as we find elsewhere in Tanakh. Nechama said that the source critics ignored that language is used in complex ways in human conversation, and one of her examples, and anyone who has, the reason I'm smiling is because anyone who's heard one of her lectures knows how she liked to act these things out. So she said, imagine two people standing at a bus stop in Yerushalayim in the middle of the summer, and it's boiling hot, as often, I'm sure you've had this experience, and the bus isn't coming, of course, and all the other bus numbers are coming, but not your bus, and one person turns to the other and says, Cham Hayom. And the other person says, Kain, Me'od Cham. So Nechama said, do you think anybody doubted that it's hot? What they're doing is they're engaging in conversation. Okay, and that's what's going on in this pasuk. God is reaching out to men to engage him in conversation. Now our second example. When Adam responds to God, who asked him, did you eat from the tree that I told you not to eat from? And Adam says, Ha'isha asher natata imadi, hi natnali mina eitz va'ochel. And Rashi comments, kan kafar betova. He was ungrateful. He shows ingratitude. And the Chama liked to say, where does Rashi get that? That's not what he says. Why did you give me the woman? I'm complaining to you. You shouldn't have done that. That's not what it says in the pasuk. All it says is, the woman gave it to me. That's all it says. So Nechama said, wait a second. There's a little bit more here. Asher natata imadi. That is specifying the woman whom you gave to me. So Nechama said, how many women were there at that time that you have to specify one? Okay, and imagine this conversation between a husband and a wife. They just bought a car. It turns out to be a clunker. And the wife says to the husband, the car that your brother recommended is a lemon. Okay? Are you reading between the lines? Probably, but that's the point. Example number three comes from Sefer Eov. This narrative tells us how the righteous man Eov suffered terrible calamities and his children were killed. All of his wealth was destroyed. And despite all of this, the Sefer says, Bechol zot lo chata Eov. With all of this, Eov did not sin. As the Satan had said to God, I'm sure he's going to curse you to your face. Im lo al panecha yivarcheka. So the Satan doesn't give up, though, and God allows him to bring bodily affliction to Eov. And he says, this is going to break him. And the narrator in the Sefer again says, Bechol zot lo chata Eov bisfatav. He didn't sin with his lips. And Rashi adds, Bilibo chata. He sinned in his heart. And that's based on the Gemara. And again, where is he getting that from? It doesn't say that. And you'll see in a few moments that Rashbam really says, hey, you're not allowed to just read into it. But Nechama liked to say that Rashi looks carefully at the language. It's not written explicitly in the text, but when you see the first time it says, Bechol zot lo chata Eov, and then lo chata Eov bisfatav. It would be like a student who maybe didn't get a good grade. Doesn't apply to my class, of course. But a teacher might say, well, that student didn't curse me to my face. Okay? Didn't curse me to my face, but you can read between the lines. And so the point is that there's something additional, an additional connotation. So what's new about Nechama's approach, since the traditional commentators already asked Makashel Rashi? When those commentators on Rashi did that, they assumed that every extra word in the Torah comes to teach you something because it's a divine text with special miraculous qualities. And this is something that James Kogel has referred to as the doctrine of omnisignificance. Every single word in the Torah is significant because it's the Torah, because it's the Word of God. Nechama differed from the traditional Rashi commentaries because she relied on the doctrine Dibra Torah Kilashon Bnei Adam. The Torah spoke as human beings do, and it's not a special miraculous work, but human beings, when they speak, sometimes you have to read between the lines. And when it's a literary work, you always have to read between the lines. Now let me emphasize that when Nechama said that you should read Tanakh as literature, she wasn't saying that the Bible is human literature. She was positing that the Word of God is expressed in a literary mode and must be interpreted as such. Nechama liked to say that we should read Tanakh as carefully as a girl in love reads letters from her beloved. She will read between the lines, scrutinize every single word, even thinking about what he didn't say and what he should have said and what he didn't mean, maybe. So if one time he writes, I had an amazing, fabulous time with you yesterday, and the next time, it was nice seeing you yesterday, she's going to say, hey, something is up. Okay, pay attention, guys. She will read between the lines when you send that text, so you have to be careful. The literary critic, likewise, applies minutely discriminating attention to the tone, sound, imagery, and syntax in Alter's words. Rashi, of course, lacked the critical apparatus of modern literary scholarship, but Nechama argued that he intuitively understood how to do a close reading. And she argued that he's not just doing homiletics, what he's doing is Pshuto Shel Rashi. So now we've explained what is different about Nechama's question, Ma Kasha L'Rashi, because it's informed by modern literary criticism, and it applies even if the Torah is taken as Lashon B'nei Adam. Let's go a step further in the theory of literature Nechama applied to Tanakh, which occupied her particularly at an early age in the 1940s and 50s, when she worked closely with Ludwig Strauss, as you see on the second side of the source sheets. As a young teacher in Israel, Nechama studied with Ludwig Strauss, a German-Jewish literary scholar, applied the new criticism to German, French, and English literature. Early in his life, Strauss was alienated from Judaism, but eventually became more affiliated and worked closely with Martin Buber. He came to Israel in 1935 after being expelled by the Nazis from his university position. In Israel, he mastered Hebrew and even became an influential Hebrew poet and literary critic. When I started teaching in Yeshiva College, one of my first courses was on Tehillim, and I asked Nechama to advise me on readings. And she suggested reading Strauss's book, Bidarkei HaSifrut, The Ways of Literature. That volume, which was published posthumously in 1954, includes an introductory chapter on literary theory and a chapter on Tehillim. I later found out that Nechama actually wrote those two chapters from dictation from Strauss on his deathbed in 1953. The paragraph cited here is from a programmatic essay, How to Read a Chapter of Tanakh, that Nechama published in Strauss's memory in 1954. Strauss characterized the reading of literature as a reproduction of the text. It's the reader who shapes the text as he or she understands it. The text itself is inanimate. It comes alive through the reader's perception and voice. Think poetry readings. The image that Nechama uses is an architectural one. The text is a blueprint, and the reader provides the materials to build the structure. Nechama showed that our great commentators were active readers of Tanakh. They didn't just tell us what the words say, they shaped its meaning. And in this spirit, I'd like to go on to the next source, the Ramban, in the introduction to Sefer Shmot. Now, you all know that the first pasuk in Sefer Shmot repeats the words of the names of Bnei Israel as they come down to Mitzrayim, and Rashi asks, why is this additional information given? Because we were already told the names of the children of Israel as they go down in Perek Memvav in Bereishit. So why repeat the information in Sefer Shmot? Rashi says, as he typically will do, quotes a Midrash, that God loves to enumerate the names of Bnei Israel, so he'll do so even if it's redundant out of his love for Bnei Israel. The Ramban views this as a Midrashic nicety, but he says, I will give you a different explanation according to Pshuto Shel Mikra. What the Ramban says here is that Sefer Shmot has a unifying theme. It is Sefer Hagalut, the Hagi'ulah, the book of exile and redemption. And the way to create a bookend, how do you start the book of exile and redemption? You begin from the beginning of the exile, and therefore Torah repeats it to create the first bookend. Then he goes on to the Ge'ulah. And here he runs into a little trouble, so you see why he's a little bit creative. Actually, maybe more than a little bit creative. When is the redemption? You say Sefer Shmot to Sefer HaGalut VaGeulah. That's very nice. When is the Ge'ulah? So the first thing I would think is when they leave Mitzrayim, that's the Ge'ulah. So the Ramban knows that we're going to think that, and he says, well, even though they left Mitzrayim, they are still wandering in the desert, and they are homeless, they don't have a national identity yet, and they don't have a homeland. So the Ramban says, the Ge'ulah means that they receive the Torah and build the Mishkan, and the Shekhinah comes down and rests among B'nai Yisrael. And this is the Ramban speaking as a Kabbalist, seeing the unification of Yisrael and the Shekhinah as the redemption, as the Ge'ulah. Now, when I see this Ramban, I always say, this is great. This is pshat. This really works very nicely. I like this way of viewing the Sefer. But Nechama shows us that essentially this is the Ramban's reading of it. It's like a painting that each viewer will look at and interpret in his or her way. And this is essentially what the Ramban is doing here. Now this insight, which you can apply many times throughout Tanakh and our Mefarshim, yields another theoretical insight that is very profound and helps us understand the phenomenon of debates among our commentators. And again, anyone who studied with Nechama Leibovitz knows that Nechama always asked, Mahu ha'evdel bein Rashi l'Ramban, bein Rashi l'Ibn Ezra. And I just had a case today in my class where a student told me, Rashi says this and Ramban says that. And Nechama used to say, Haderech hazo hi psula l'chalutin. You should never tell your students to paraphrase. You should always tell them to explain what is the difference between them, because there's a debate going on. Now, how do you understand a debate, though? What does that mean? Who is right? And the rabbis say there's a very famous adage, Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim chayim. Both are correct. But what does that mean? Both are correct. What was the intention of the author? What did God mean when he wrote this pasuk? Or if it's a historical narrative, what really happened? And this is a point that Ibn Ezra, our great commentator, makes when he says that pshat means the correct interpretation, and there can only be one correct interpretation. Now, there can be times where we don't know the correct interpretation, so there will be a machloket, but both of them aren't really right. Only one can be right. And actually, he was not the first one to say this. There was a great Karaite commentator in Yerushalayim in the 9th century, Daniel Al-Kumisi, who said this, and he criticized the rabbis for saying that every pasuk has 49 meanings, and we know Shivim Panim LaTorah. But this is something Ibn Ezra adopted as well, and I like that. It makes sense. Only one meaning, only one thing could have been intended. But the Talmud, in the Talmud you see a different ideology. There's the very famous story in the Talmud of Rabbi Eliezer, who had a debate with the other rabbis, and they rejected his view, and they paskened according to the majority, and a bat kol came down, a voice came down from heaven, and God said, I agree with Rabbi Eliezer. And the rabbi said, lo bashamayim hi, it doesn't matter. We paskened differently. And that tells you that the power to interpret is given to the rabbis, the authority to interpret, regardless of the original intention. Now, you might think, okay, that's when it comes to halacha. Maybe you can say, you know, maybe that can be more flexible, and depending on whom you talk to. But in the case of history, shouldn't that be dictated by the facts? Only one factual description can be true, can be correct. But in the next source, source number 3, you see that the Talmud applies this to a historical event, and you see a fascinating discussion where Eliyahu HaNavi tells Rabbi Aviatar that God is studying the story of Pilegesh B'Giv'ah. And how does God study? He has a mikros gedolos in front of him, and he says, Eviatar b'ni kachu omer, Yonatan b'ni kachu omer. There are two opinions among the rabbis. So the Gemara says, what, God doesn't know what happened? How can that be? So they say, Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim chayim. Both are correct. What does that mean? The theory of new criticism offers a very useful solution here. The theory of new criticism famously rejected the intentional fallacy. The intentional fallacy means that don't think that what the author intended is what the text means. The text has an independent existence beyond what the author intended. Sometimes when that guy wrote the text, that poor guy said, I had a good time last night, he didn't mean anything bad by that, but when you put it next to, I had a fabulous time, it means something. You can read between the lines, and the new criticism says that the work of literature has multiple interpretations, like a painting. The painter had one thing in mind, someone else looks at it and has a different way of viewing it. Furthermore, a literary representation of a historical event is not the same as a transcript of the history of what really happened. Like any literary work, the Bible has a narrative life of its own as a work of art. And again, it's like a painting that's a representation of the history, or it's like the script of a play that the director has the discretion of how to portray the characters within it. And to quote Strauss, it's the reproduction of the text. So even if we accept the fundamental historicity of Tanakh, we must embrace the multiple interpretations offered by the tradition of Parshanut. And let me illustrate this concept. I know it's hard to sometimes imagine it, but let's see, if you see concrete examples, you'll see how this plays out. So let's go back to our example from Sefer Iyov, where it says, "Bechol zot lo chata Iyov bisfatav," and Rashi says, "Bilibo chata." But Rashbam says, according to Pshat, he didn't sin with his lips, and there's no indication that he sinned with his heart. So Rashbam says he didn't sin at all. And who is correct? Now, a historically minded critic might say that ultimately only one interpretation can be correct, because it depends on what really happened. You know, you'd have to go back and try to figure that out. If you had a tape recorder, well, that went inside his heart and could tell, then you would be able to see. But Mechama, following Ludwig Strauss and the new criticism, believe that Tanakh, like any literary text, is subject to multiple interpretations, and it's like the script of a play. So there are just two ways to read Sefer Iyov, and it has independence from the original historical background. Now, some of you may know that the Rambam in Moreh Nevuchim says that Iyov lo haya velo nivra ela mashal haya, that the whole story is a fiction. Okay, so dial it back for a moment. If it's a fiction, obviously there can't be a correct interpretation. It's whatever interpretation you give it. Now, again, a diehard intentional, someone who goes with intentional view would say, well, it depends what the author had in mind. Well, we know that that's nonsense. If it's a work of fiction, it's whatever you read into it, whatever the play you put on, how you do it. The Ten Commandments came out in different views, how Moses looked, how Yocheved looked. These are all now literary representations. So it doesn't depend on the Rambam's view of it being a fiction. I'm actually, because of the lateness of the hour, I will skip example number 5, even though it's an amazing example, but you can look at that on your own later. Our last example is source number 6, and it illustrates how well the classical commentators can serve as a guide to the openness of the biblical narrative. In the story preceding Yaakov's first meeting with Esav, after years of separation, we read how he sent messengers with gifts to his older brothers. And then the messengers returned and they said, "Banu elachicha leSav, v'gam olech likratcha, v'adame ot ishimo." Esav is coming with 400 men. Rashi, which I didn't quote here, but you all know, Rashi says, "Elachicha leSav" means that he's still the brother that you remember and he still hates your guts and he wants to kill you. So look out. And why did Rashi say that? Probably, well, apart from the fact that it's in the Midrash, but what's the very next thing Yaakov does? He prepares for the worst. So it means that Yaakov understood this as a threat. And that's the way Rashi understands the words of the messengers. He's coming with 400 men to get you. Rashbam, fascinating, says, no, it doesn't mean that. Lefi pshuto, he's coming with 400 men to honor you. This is an honor guard. And that's what Rashbam says. Now, Rashbam is probably motivated by the fact that when Esav actually comes, doesn't do anything bad. He hugs him and he kisses him. So, and what about Yaakov preparing for the worst? So Rashbam says Yaakov didn't believe the messengers. Okay, so who's right? Did the messenger say he's coming to honor you, or did the messenger say he's coming to kill you? It's impossible to know who is correct here and what implications can be drawn from the cryptic words of the messengers. In fact, Rav Yosef Bechor Shor, who was a student of Rashbam's younger brother, Rabbeinu Tam, opens another possibility. And he paraphrases the words of the messengers in this way. Lo yadanu ma bedato im tov im ra, ki lo hashivanu klum. We don't know. We don't know what his intentions are because he didn't tell us. And you know what, Bechor Shor, that's a pretty good interpretation. Because what are the words of the messengers? We came to your brother Esav, and he's coming with 400 men. It doesn't give any clue as far as the intentions. So here we have a third interpretation, which I happen to like it best, but still, because of Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim Chayim, this is not an attempt to reconstruct the history. These are all valid interpretations that are welcome by active readers who reproduce the text. There have been many advances in Bible scholarship since the 1920s. All of the schools we've mentioned originally developed dramatically since then. They're even represented in Orthodox Jewish Bible scholarship, and I've enumerated them at the bottom of the source sheet. The field of Parshanut HaMikra has grown immensely with the discovery and publication of new commentaries from manuscripts and studies that reveal the cultural world of our great commentators. These new studies often seek to interpret the words of our commentators against the backdrop of their cultural milieu. So, for example, we know that Rabbeinu Sadia Gaon and Ibn Ezra had battles with the Karaites, and Rashi and Rashbam had polemics with their Christian neighbors, and this often helps us understand why they commented what they commented. Historically oriented scholars have been able to advance our study of the biblical period through new archaeological discoveries made possible in large part, by the creation of the State of Israel. Many of us have been on Teulim that trace the footsteps of Abraham or Yehoshua, and we went a few years ago to Beersheba, and we saw some Arab guy was, this is the Be'er of Abraham. This is his well, okay? Believe it or don't believe it, but we've been, okay, more seriously, we've been at the place, pretty sure, where David killed Goliath. That's pretty certain, and Rav Yoel Ben Nun, for example, is one very prominent name of an individual, an Israeli scholar, who pioneered a whole school of thought that advocates learning Tanakh on one's feet with a map of the land of Israel. Even the source-critical method has orthodox adherents, famously Rav Mordechai Breuer, who applied his aspects theory, Shitat HaBchinot, and he argues that the Torah reflects different and sometimes seemingly contradictory perspectives. And these are the very contradictions that were posited by the documentary hypothesis. Nechama resisted all three of these other approaches and maintained her literary approach, using it to appreciate the great traditional commentators. She vehemently opposed Rabbi Breuer's method. She often remarked to him also that the words of the critical scholars were nonsense, apart from being heretical. Sometimes I think that she had a blind spot for their considerable literary sensitivities, which Rabbi Breuer capitalized on. Nechama saw little value in the historical approach and had scant interest in archaeological finds. Someone once took her to Anatot, which is now an Arab village, or was then an Arab village, and they said, this is the birthplace of the prophet Yirmiyahu. And she said, you're showing me an Arab village. This doesn't tell me anything about Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyahu Anavi is his prophecies. He's the prophet who told Bnei Israel to do tshuva, who told them that the Beit HaMikdash is not the be-all and end-all of Yahadut. And he's the prophet of consolation when Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. Showing me this birthplace, that's not his legacy. Nechama also didn't go for the cultural method of the Rishonim of interpreting the great commentators I'll give one brief example. Rashi on Breishit Dalet Aleph, V'ha'adam yada et Chava ishto. This is the story that Chava conceived and had children. This is written in Perek Dalet after the expulsion from Gan Eden. And Rashi makes a comment that V'ha'adam yada means that the conception, Chava's conception, was already in Gan Eden. Kvar kodem inyan shel mala. And Elazar Tuito, a scholar of Rashi, a great scholar of Rashi, Zichrono Livracha, pointed out that if you look in contemporaneous Christian commentators, they said exactly the opposite. They said that the conception had to have occurred outside of the Garden of Eden because it is incompatible with the pristine state to have sexual relations in Gan Eden. And so he said that Rashi was engaged in a polemic with the Christians. Nechama didn't like that. She didn't go for it. She liked Tuito very much. But she didn't go for that interpretation. And she said, look, Rashi is interpreting the biblical text, and he's giving us a timeless message. And she didn't want to look at Rashi as engaged in polemic. So finally, we can ask the question, why did Nechama resist all of these methods? Was it because of the heretical nature of the historical critical method? Was it because she was, in fact, a traditionalist after all? Did she think that viewing the commentators as motivated by concerns specific to their time somehow limits them? Let's see if we can offer at least a conjectural answer to these questions. In the 1990s, a fierce ideological battle raged between Nechama Leibovitz and Yoel Ben Nun. What particularly rankled Nechama was Yoel Ben Nun's claims to have arrived at the single correct interpretation based on his careful analysis of the biblical text. Now, what he argued was that now, with the state of Israel, what we should do is study what he called Tanakh Naki, no commentaries, because the commentators lived in Galut, they lived in the exile, they didn't see the state of Israel, they didn't see the places, so they don't know what we know now. And Nechama was very disturbed by this. She said, do you really think that your Perush is better than Rashi or Ramban? And Rav Yoel would later say to people that Nechama is such a traditionalist, it's very hard for her to get out of the mindset of the only the traditional commentaries. But I think that the matter is a lot more complex than Rav Yoel Ben Nun would wish to admit. Nechama often quoted non-traditional commentators such as Martin Buber or Benno Yaakov or for that matter, Ludwig Strauss. And she was very attached to Ludwig Strauss. She didn't reject non-orthodox interpretations as such. What she objected to was the thought that someone today could argue that he has found the single correct interpretation of the biblical text to the exclusion of all others. In her view, the biblical text as a literary work is always subject to multiple interpretations. In other words, Nechama's objection is based on a theoretical understanding of the nature of Tanakh as a literary work. It cannot simply be reduced to a single correct interpretation. It's not a cipher to be decoded. The Word of God embodied in Tanakh is much richer. It's expressed in the sacred text as a literary work of art that must be viewed from a variety of perspectives, Shivim Panim LaTorah. Let me conclude with three personal notes. On a very personal note, when our fourth child was born, my wife, Suzanne, who's here in the audience tonight, and I decided to name our daughter after Nechama Leibovitz, since we are both teachers of Tanakh, and she influenced both of us so profoundly. Second, I'd like to explain why I find Nechama's approach most meaningful in my own study of Tanakh. I attended Rabbi Yoel Ben Nun's lectures at the Machon when I was studying for my doctorate at Revel during the same year I studied with Nechama. At Revel, I was trained to engage in critical thinking and independent analysis. Rabbi Yoel's lectures were conducted in a completely different way. Students came into class with their clean Tanakh that you see over here, I kept it from back then, without commentaries, and wrote down his very impressive and well-supported interpretations in their notebooks. So they had their Tanakh and their notebook, but not Rashi or Ramban. Now, to be sure, some of those present who were advanced students and teachers themselves would argue with Rav Yoel. But students were not given the tools in his classes to think critically or arrive at their own interpretation. And to me, this seemed like a limitation, in part because I was a student of Rav Lichtenstein at Gush and a student in Rav Soloveitchik here at YU. Their method of teaching was to train students to think independently. I therefore found Nechama's approach to be most congenial to me. My last comment. In my own scholarship, I have to admit, I haven't followed Nechama's philosophy completely. As many of my students know, and some of them are here tonight, welcome, I believe that we can better understand our great commentators by placing them within their historical contexts and identifying the ways in which they at times drew upon non-Jewish learning in their intellectual milieu. But I fundamentally believe that Nechama is absolutely correct, that the new criticism and its conception of literary analysis enables us to best appreciate the notion that Tanakh is legitimately subject to multiple interpretations. Within this framework, all of the traditional commentators can partake in its analysis, joined by new voices in our time that together reveal the multifaceted meaning of God's words. And many of you in this audience are also Talmidim of Rav Soloveitchik, Zichrono Livracha, and you remember that he said that when he gave Shi'ur, he felt as though Rabbeinu Tam walked into the room and the Rambam walked into the room and was debating with the students, and that's that sense that I have from Nechama as well. In conclusion, Nechama's approach certainly has elements of older traditional methods, but it is invigorated by a new literary outlook, which ensures its continued relevance in the 21st century. Like Nechama herself, who remained impressively youthful into her 90s, her teachings remain vibrant today. I would like to express my thanks to Mrs. Esther Manischewitz for sharing her recollections of Nechama from the 1930s and a wish for her for the same bracha. Od yunuvun b'seiva b'sheinim v'rananim yihiyu. Lehagid ki ashar Adonai tzuri v'lo avlata bo. Thank you.